Welcome back, America. Hugh Hewitt. That music means I'm joined by Admiral James Stavridis, retired United States Navy. Hey, Admiral, good morning. How are you?
Doing great, Hugh. How are you?
I'm terrific. I see 2034 behind you, still on bestseller list as people turn their eyes towards China and wonder what's ahead. Congratulations. Keeping a novel on those lists this long is really something. It's spreading. I'm sure you're very pleased with that.
I am. And two comments. One is any number of my very senior friends who are retired military, retired ambassadors say, hey, Jim, you wrote a great book, but you got one big thing wrong, the date. They feel, many of them, that this is a looming tower that is much closer than 2034. And there's something to be said about that. And that's my second point, which is, yeah, it's on the New York Times fiction bestseller list. Let's keep it on the fiction side.
On the fiction side. And reading it is actually one of the ways to do that. That's why I love the work of Daniel Silva and others who write thrillers that educate. Let me turn to three stories. The first one is just awful. The wreck of the KRI Nanggala 402, the Indonesian submarine, 53 sailors are dead. They recognized it. They've got the debris. They were loading torpedo tubes at the time they lost contact, Admiral. Now, when you were running Southern Command and NATO, you had a lot of submarines in your control. Wasn't your calling, but I know you must know a lot in the submarine community. How dangerous is it what they were doing at the time that this happened, to this tragedy? And it's an ally, right? It's an allied Navy. What happened?
Yeah, first of all, good point to be made here is that these are diesel submarines, the one that went down. The submarines that the U.S. Navy operates are nuclear powered. As a result of being nuclear powered, they are much stronger structurally because they have to be, because there's a nuclear reactor inside them. So a diesel boat, and this was a fairly old diesel boat, they're just a little less solidly constructed. They're made to operate in shallower water. They're not designed to go super deep the way our nukes are. And yes, one of the vulnerable things you do, if you think about it, is torpedo tubes. Because at some point, if you're going to launch a torpedo out of a submarine, you have to open it up to the ocean. So it's a delicate operation, and sometimes things go wrong. It's a tragic event. All mariners feel it, and let's face it, it's an awful way to die. If viewers want to get a better sense of what it's like in a diesel boat, I'm sure, Hugh, you've seen the really remarkable film Das Boot, The Boat,
yes,
about the German U-boat. Things have changed a lot on diesel submarines since then, but the basic sense of being in a very small, very confined space, and in that film, watching what happens will give you a sense of what the final moments for this tragically lost crew must have been like.
You know, I visited, I can't remember the name, I think it might be the Finn. There's a submarine from World War II berthed permanently at Hawaii at Pearl Harbor, on which I went just to get a sense of what a World War II submariner lived with, and boy, welcome to your coffin that you're going to float in for the next year and a half underwater. It's just as I couldn't have done it. I'd have gone crazy. I don't even like MRIs.
The point I'll make there is that the submarine force had the highest level of casualties on a percentage basis than any other force in the U.S. military in the Second World War.
I did not know that.
Percentage of the force. It was the riskiest duty you could take. And also, if you look at percentage of medals of honor, Navy crosses for enormously heroic acts, you really got to hand it to, as they call themselves, the silent service. I like to refer to these days as a Navy destroyer officer. We refer to them as targets, but they have the same expression for us. But listen, let me tell you, in all seriousness, even if I strapped on the most modern, deadly destroyer, anti-submarine destroyer, that would be one of our Arleigh Burkes. I'm not sure I'd want to tangle with a U.S. trained nuclear submarine. Those folks are pretty damn good down under.
Let's get more of them. This brings me to my second subject. Our friend Jerry Hendricks wrote for the Wall Street Journal about infrastructure and shipbuilding. I want to take it a step further. Tomorrow I'm going to have Washington Post writer Joby Warwick on. He's written this new book called Red Line. And in this book is a story within a story about the USS, what was it called? The Ray, it's from the Cape Ray, the USS Reserve Fleet takes the Cape Ray out of mothballs and turns it into a chemical weapons disposal factory. It's truly one of the most extraordinary innovation stories I've ever read. I didn't know anything about it. I don't know if you were running NATO at the time, but are you acquainted with what we did with the Cape Ray and how we did it?
Not in great depth, Hugh, but I'm a big fan of Joe B. Warwick. He wrote a Pulitzer Prize winning book several years ago about it's called Black Flags, about the rise of ISIS, if you really want to understand the rise of ISIS. So if someone who is as good a reporter as Toby is going to dive into something like that, I'm going to reserve judgment till I actually read the book, and I'll make some comments when I have read it, because he's a terrific writer, and it is a fascinating story.
It's called Red Line, Red Line, Red Line. That's all people have to end. The last name is Warwick, W-A-R-R-I-C-K, Warwick, and Red Line will get you there, and I'll talk to him tomorrow. So, Admiral, it leads me to this. They pulled it out of the reserve fleet, so I called up Captain Hendricks, and I said, how ready is the ready reserve? And he said, it's not very ready. And it gets worse every year. It's like our maritime capacity. What's your assessment of the ready reserve? And this is the maritime fleet. This is one of these roll on and go. I don't know what they call them. There's a term for them. They're just giant container ships that can move everything. And he said, yeah, they're berthed, but they're not ready to go. Do you share that dim view?
I do, although it varies, and Jerry would know this well and would say the same thing. It's one thing to talk about, say, a destroyer, a high-end combat ship that's in mothballs, as the saying goes. Those will take a considerable amount of time to pull out, to get all those electronics back up to speed, to get the connectivity restored, to do all of the end-to-end communications testing. Very difficult. Months, if not a year plus, to get them ready to go in at the most basic level in combat. At the other end are what you're referring to, the big, they're called ro-ros, roll-on, roll-off. Yeah, it just means it's an obvious term for you roll stock, big platforms, tanks even, on and off. And so those are relatively simple platforms, and they can be brought back up to speed, I would say, in months. But it varies. None of them are like, you know, cars in the parking lot at a used car dealership where you just go out, put the key in, and drive it away. It will take months to, in some cases, a year or more to get these ships ready to go. So let me make a point about this, which is another important event today. We talk about the size of the U.S. fleet. Guess who deployed a carrier strike group today? The Brits. Oh. The 65,000-ton aircraft carrier, air wing of about 40 aircraft, including the F-35 Lightning. This is a carrier strike group centered around Queen Elizabeth. Two of their very high-end anti-air destroyers, equally capable almost to our Aegis ships, two of their absolutely high-end anti-submarine warfare ships, two auxiliaries, so a real carrier strike group. We deployed a destroyer with it, and the Dutch deployed a frigate with it. So my point is, yeah, the ready reserve ain't ready, but our allies are ready. And where is that carrier strike group going, Hugh? It's going
South China
to
Sea.
One of the South China Sea and the Indian Ocean. It's going to hit 40 countries and be very much a part of our allies saying to China, we stand with the United States. That, I think, is the deployment of the day.
That is a great bit of news. I had one other story to bring up to you, which is this week Israel launched its first new generation of missile boat. Now, people don't think of Israel as being a maritime power, but they've got to protect their coast. They've got to protect their natural gas fields. And this missile boat is small, but it carries quite a punch. And I'm wondering, is that the wave of the future? If the Chinese are threatening, as we see in 2034, to bury our carriers under a hailstorm of missiles, don't you just replicate a whole bunch, a swarm of these missile boats on the size that Israel has and put them in Japan and friendlier places and boom, you've got a deterrent to the deterrent?
Yeah, indeed. And by the way, let's add to the concern by saying that increasingly they'll be armed not with, if you will, conventional surface-to-surface missiles, but what are called hypersonics, which move at five times the speed of sound. A conventional one goes about the speed of sound. So this is a very significant threat. And by the way, it's not just Israel and not just China. Iran is very big in this game. We just saw Iranian Revolutionary Guard warships, very small, very fast, swarming a U.S. Coast Guard cutter in the Arabian Gulf. So yes, a significant part of combat power in the littorals by Israel, Iran, but also by great powers, by China inside that first island chain, is going to be these fast patrol boats. So what do we counter with, I think, is the question. This is part of where the Commandant of the Marine Corps, General Berger, David Berger, who I've spoken with you about before, who is one of the premier thinkers we've got right now on active duty, is talking about using Marines in a very lethal way. That will be one of the threats they would seek to neutralize.
Last question, Admiral. When we talk about these small boats, does the United States have a counterpart to them? Do we build anything like the Israelis and the Iranians?
We do not. And I personally think it is well worth exploring. The other thing we don't build is where we started this conversation, are diesel submarines. And, you know, I spoke earlier about their limitations, but in the littorals, because they're very quiet, they're battery operated, they're much, much, much less expensive than the nuclear attack boats. I think you can make a case for a mix of a small number of diesels built by ourselves, but really the people who build great diesel boats are the Germans, the Japanese, the Italians, the French, because they've been doing it since the end of World War II, and we focused on nuclear-powered boats. So diesel submarines we don't do, and patrol boats we don't do. When I first came on active duty in 1976, otherwise known as 1.2 million years ago, we did operate a small fleet of fast missile boats, and they were home ported in Key West, Florida. Do you think that
good
was
duty?
That was a fun part of the Navy. Unfortunately, we decommissioned those. I think looking at small boat, high punch offense, and I think diesels are both worth a look. Not sure we'd land there and actually build them, but we had to study that and take a look. That'd be a good question for your friend Jerry Hendricks.
Admiral James Stavridis, always a pleasure. The author of 2034 best-selling book on the New York Times list. Talk to you next week. Admiral, you're looking good. Thank you for joining me per usual. Always a great conversation.